I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back to Outside the Box Set Pod, Creative Kale, a spin-off to the Box Set Podcast, where I am joined by one guest who tries to make sense of the creative world of work. My name is Howell. Last time I was joined by Michael Myers, who was the director of photography for the West Wing, and he taught me a number of things. He taught me that, but mostly that perhaps my feelings of animosity towards the lack of creativity around the world of media come from the fact that I was a theatre person first, that perhaps 3 years of drama school actually taught me a bunch of skills that others don't get the chance to learn. It was him saying that he worked with actors and people who'd worked in the theatre world, and they seemed to have a greater articulation, a greater palette. It's funny that I can't find the word to describe. Well, anyway, that was interesting. I'm still mulling on that. And now I interview Justin Lee Collins, a man who presented many programmes that I loved and with very much a sense of personality throughout them, which is something I've always been fascinated with, is how, and I wanted to learn how he managed to make big budget TV shows with such a silly clown-like character at the centre, and how on earth that's possible with the pressure of time and money and committees of TV executives able to get in the way of that. How he was able to garner the trust to do that, I suppose. We spoke about many things. Don't forget, back in the Box Set Pod a couple of weeks ago, he featured. So if you want to hear him talking about Stranger Things, go back. But right now, here's the continuation of that chat into the wider creative universe. By the way, just a quick side thought, recorded on my Mac, which is why it sounds dreadful. I forgot to mention, Justin and I keep referring to this podcast as the Creative Juice Podcast. That's before we found out that there was another Creative Juice Podcast, and then we renamed it Creative Kale, which was also Justin's idea, so he gets blame in both cases. Okay, welcome to the Creative Juice Podcast. we've just been discussing things on the Box Set Pod podcast. This might be a few weeks later now, who knows. We've been talking about Stranger Things. Let's talk. The point of this podcast is to get to the bottom of your experience of how things are made and how you think great things are made, how you think people manage to screw up making great things.
Okay.
The Netflix model, right? So you're a big Netflix fan.
Huge Netflix fan.
So am I. Have you got Now TV as well?
No, I don't have Now TV. I've just got Apple TV.
So have I. Isn't it great?
And I love it. It's the future about now. It's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
And we subscribe to Netflix, and for a month we subscribe to Amazon Prime.
Because you got a free trial, you cheap bastard.
Well, I am cheap, but we wanted to watch The Jinx, and that's on Amazon Prime, and we love The Jinx. That's a huge recommendation. We haven't stuck with Amazon Prime, but you know, it's there. We'll go back potentially.
Well, on Now TV, which is $6.99 a month, you can get Silicon Valley. Have you seen that?
I haven't even heard of it.
It's created by Mike Judge, as in Beavis and Butthead and things
Brilliant.
Like that.
But it's love it already.
It's live action. It's like five, six guys, mainly following one guy who comes up with an amazing new idea in Silicon Valley, and it's a satire on Silicon Valley, but it's done very much in the style of... No, it's not in the style of Beavis and Butthead at all. Forget Beavis and Butthead. But the gags... For example, there's one episode where they have this amazing moment where they realise they can take on another business, and they go into like a minute or two of exposition
where they're going, how will this work? And they're explaining why this epiphany's happened. But meanwhile, a guy at the back of the room who realizes it before everyone else, who goes, he's smoking a massive bong. And he goes, and it's him who goes, no, this is a great opportunity. And for the entire 2-3 minutes of them explaining it, he has a coughing fit. So he's just pointing at him and they're picking up on what he meant. But he's coughing so loudly that it's like exactly the same level in the mix as the exposition.
And that's genius. Like
3 minutes. That's genius. And whenever he manages to get the coughing under control, he's about to join in and say something else, but he takes another drag on the bong and goes back back into the cough. And
that's
it's
brilliant.
Scenes like that, like they'll do a 4 minute build up to a heist situation.
That's great.
And then someone will trip up and drop the plans for the heist in front of the person they're trying to con.
Okay.
It's like constant long setups followed by massive embarrassing failure.
Right. I'm going there.
It's
That's
brilliant. It's brilliant.
That is genius.
I'm plowing through it.
I'm going to go there.
Anyway, long way around that is it seems to me at the moment that people. Netflix and places are realizing that if they give some talented people a bunch of money and leave them to it, they'll create something awesome.
Absolutely.
And I wonder what your experience of that is, having been in the murky world of TV and things.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's when you get the best stuff. I think when you need to hire the right people. So obviously the idea needs to be in place, you know, whether that's a scripted idea or not. You need to have a really, really strong idea, a brilliant idea. And then you bring in the right people, you know, both on the creative side and on the production side and the technical side. You bring in the right people to do it, the people who know how it should be done, people with a very clear vision of how it should be done. And then once all of that is in place, the decision makers need to then have the strength of their convictions, because obviously they commissioned it in the first place, and then just let you go. And then my experience is, if they can let
that going right and wrong,
right and wrong, if they can let you go, then you'll deliver. Invariably you will deliver on the promise that was made. And it's a group decision, so you all have to get together, you know, commissioners and channel bosses and department bosses, you know, the suits, the men, and you all get together, all the creatives, and then you make those decisions, and then you go and do it. And if they can allow you, give you the space to go and do it and have the confidence, I think it just comes down to confidence. Once that decision has been made, go and do it. And, you know, I'll see you in 6 weeks or 8 weeks or, you know, however long it takes to make the thing, however long you've been given.
We've probably both signed contracts in the past that say that we can't discuss company secrets having left and stuff. So let's not mention specifics. Yeah. But have you been in the situation where that hasn't happened, where that's going to happen in theory, but then you've just been interfered with constantly?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I can give you examples of both ends of that spectrum, but also within, more specifically within series, you know, it's been that way. Mm-hmm. You know, I did a series. The first thing that springs to mind would be the Bring Back series that I did, which was a series of 8 films for Channel 4 that we made over the course of about 4 years. We managed to make it, should have been more, but these films were incredibly difficult to pull off. So
were
what
they?
Could have been yeah
is that because you
difficult.
Were genuinely on the fly with a lot of it
genuinely on the fly. I mean, not always in the way that you might think, but certainly genuinely on the fly when it came to making it work and delivering and actually having a film with a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Yeah.
They were hugely, hugely difficult to pull off, and not just because, you know, one or two cast members wouldn't agree to take part, or I couldn't find one or two cast members. You know, there was an awful lot more to it than that, and it was really difficult to come up with targets, if you like. You know, we would, and that's why we only did, I mean, partly budget because they were really expensive, but the main reason why we only did so few is because they were, you know, really difficult to decide upon which one we should do and which one could we realistically pull off, and how open do we think the cast members of this show or that film, or how open might they be to an overweight hairy Bristolian running up to them on the street, you know.
Well, the Mr. So, T thing stands out as you're talking. Mr. T, I don't know whether he was easy or hard to get, but certainly you and him couldn't really be from more different backgrounds.
No, absolutely. I mean, he was, we wouldn't have got Mr. T unless, you know, we paid him a substantial amount of money. So that's what we had to do with Mr. T.
Really? I was going to say, so, is that what you mean by budget?
Yeah, I mean, you know, a big portion of the budget went on Mr. T, because, and this isn't sort of a reveal, if you like, because actually if you see Bring Back the A-Team in the film, it got to the point where literally the day before we were flying home, I still hadn't managed to get Mr. T, or we still hadn't managed to get Mr. T to agree to be involved. We tried absolutely everything. So in the film, in the end, we just said, okay, look, you know, how much is it going to cost? Can we just have, like, can we have him for an hour in a hotel room? Because, of course, George Peppard.
How much do you get out for
an hour? I can never remember, and I think in the end, I think we had him for probably for about 90 minutes, and I can never remember if it was pounds or dollars, but it was something like 75 grand, I think. Yeah. It's huge. It was
Jesus
just massive.
Christ.
It's huge. I know. It was insane. Just insane.
That's like, you know, how much do you want to pay to be mildly terrified for 90 minutes?
I know, but do you know what? He was worth every penny, because it's Mr. T, and he was just awesome.
Yeah.
And he was absolutely the best contributor in that film. And, you know, and I got Face, and I got Murdoch, and, you know, Colonel Decker threatened to cut me, and that was fantastic. I don't remember if that even made it into the film.
I don't know.
But... Lance Legault, sadly no longer with us. You remember Colonel Decker in the 18?
Yeah.
So Colonel, I didn't track him down. I mean, he was of a certain age at the time, but we invited him to the reunion. So he came along. Yeah. I thought, I'll grasp the opportunity to have a chat with the A-Team's number one nemesis. Like, he was the main guy chasing them, throughout those five seasons.
Yeah.
And he's sitting there, he's about 70 at the time, in a baseball cap. And I start asking him questions. And as I'm asking him these questions, he takes like a pocket knife out of his pocket, or like a Swiss Army knife, and pulls out the blade and sort of points at me. And I think, what on earth is he doing? And then he just said, I'll never forget it. This is verbatim. He said, Justin, I'll cut you long, deep, and continuously. That's verbatim. Colonel Decker pulled a knife on me and said, Justin, I'll cut you long, deep, and continuously. I was terrified. Absolutely terrified.
Is he an eccentric, insane person, or was he actually threatening you?
No, he wasn't actually threatening me at all. I think he was brilliantly, wonderfully eccentric
part.
And funny.
Right.
And I went from terror to, you know, hysterics. In a very short space of time.
That's the kind of story you hear about, like, Michael Jackson or something, isn't it? Just like,
just
bizarrely, people who've been in some universe that the rest of us aren't part of for a long time.
No. But it's just, obviously, I wouldn't change that for the world. Like, I couldn't wait to get home and start telling people.
Continuously
that,
is the word
continuously,
that surprises me.
Yeah, if he'd have just gone with I'll cut you long and deep and stop there, wouldn't be much of a story.
Well, long, deep, and hard, or something. But he's gone with quite a quite a descriptive, almost corporate word.
Well, I think maybe in his eyes, I don't know, a deer or something. Yeah. I don't know. But it was hilarious. And then obviously, you know, there was a pause. It was, you know, seemed significant enough at the time. It was probably half a second. And then he laughed and I burst out laughing and he put the knife away and we carried on. It was wonderful.
Right. So to take this back to the beginning, this is an example. That series is an example of you literally being given a budget and going and planting your ass in LA for a month.
Yeah, absolutely right.
How often did... So it was a separate production... It was your production company? It was a separate production company?
No, it wasn't. It's actually... It's quite a history on that side of things. So it started out as one production company, and then the executive producer that was at that particular production company left that company and sort of took the brand with him.
Right.
And then with another producer that was brought on to do the A-Team, they started their own company. Mm. And then by the time we did, I think, Bring Back Dallas, which was after the A-Team, they became umbrellaed by a production company called So, which was owned by Graham Norton and his colleague Graham Stewart.
Okay.
So's now part of ITV Studios, but I think. So it's quite a convoluted history with that. But it's a little company called Zeal started it.
Zeal. And they didn't... Yeah. Channel 4 then, how many phone calls did you get saying how's it going over there? Like generally they left you to it.
Well, in the beginning, and this I can tell you exactly how it happened in the very beginning. Mm. I think 2004, and this was a time where doors were now opening at the channel for me, and people were saying, what do you want to do? And do you fancy doing this? And, you know, that those kind of conversations were happening. And then out of the blue, I'll remember it vividly because it was about 2 weeks before Christmas. Mm. And I met the executive producer who I became good friends with, lovely guy called Simon Tucker, and his director, a young guy called Robbie. And I met them at Channel 4 with my then agent, and they pitched to me a one-off televised pilot for Channel 4 called Bring Back Spandau Ballet.
Right.
And to cut a long story short, I was given a dossier on Spandau Ballet. Now, you have to remember, this is when Spandau Ballet were in litigation and there was like a court thing going on between...
So it's probably
a few dossiers around. This is like years before they decided to reunite and, you know, tour and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
So it was Bring Back Spandau Ballet. So this dossier was huge. I mean, it was the size of the old-fashioned Yellow Pages, you know, pre-internet Yellow Pages, right? Mm, yeah. So I'm boning up on this dossier over my Christmas break, only to be told, come January, forget Spandau Ballet, it's never going to happen. How about Grange Hill? So I had to get my head around that. Looking back now, what was brilliant about that first one that we made in 2004, I think it went out in 2005, Bring Back Grange Hill, is that none of us had a clue what we were doing. None of us had a clue. And I remember, I'll never forget, running up to Ziggy Greaves, the actor who played George, his surname escapes me now, I'm so sorry, George from Liverpool, lovely George, oh my goodness, but he played Ziggy Greaves.
Yeah.
And I ran up to him, or we ran up to him, I think it was Waterloo Station, and he looked petrified, didn't know what was happening. George Christopher, I think I'm right in saying, Christopher, aka Ziggy Greaves. We had absolutely no clue how to do it, how to make this work, how to pull it together, but we did it and it worked. And of course, it went out and it was a big hit. And then Channel 4 commissioned 4 off the back of it. And we ended up only making 3. We made one for budget reasons. There was only the money to do one big one.
Right.
And that one big one was the A-Team. Mm. And the other two, we thought, well, we better do a couple that's a bit closer to home with people who might be on paper easier to get.
Yeah.
So we did Bring Back the One Hit Wonders and Bring Back the Christmas Number One, which were a couple of bringbacks that not many people remember, but we did them.
Yeah.
But the A-Team just, you know, ate all the budget and took up all of our time. And I think there was kind of a change by the time we got to Bring Back Dallas the following year, because of course it gets to the point where now you have a template now, so you obviously try and you know, adopt that same template regardless of whoever it is you're going after or whatever the subject is. And I sort of think along the way, almost inevitably, maybe a little bit of magic gets lost.
Yeah.
Because, of course, when your targets become that much bigger. I mean, we did bring back Star Wars, for goodness sake. There's nothing bigger. Mm. So when your targets get bigger and budgets start going up and up and up and up, and there's a lot more resting on it, you know, it's not Grange Hill anymore, it's Star Wars or it's Star Trek or it's Dallas. Mm. Then I'm not talking about interference. I'm not talking about anyone sort of interfering or getting too involved, but the creative process changes. Of course it does, because there's a lot more resting on it. And when I look back now, Bring Back Grange Hill isn't my favorite of the bringbacks. Mm. I love the A team, and I think probably Bring Back Fame, which is the last one we did, the last of the eight, that's probably the best film I think we made in that series.
Yeah.
But there's something about that magic of that very first one that I couldn't see at the time.
Yes.
At the time, I was nervous and I was like, what are we doing? What, does anybody know what we're doing? Does anyone know what's going on? And I'll never forget Robbie, the director. I think we were going after Roland, you know, Erkan Mustafa.
Yeah.
And I can't remember if this is in the film or not, because Bring Back Grange Hill I haven't watched for years. But I remember Robbie trying to draw me a map of where we thought Roland was going to be. And it was just, it might as well have been hieroglyphs. Mm. It was nonsensical. And I said, is this? And he said to me, does that make sense? And I said, no, I've got no idea where I was going, what we were doing.
Yeah.
And there's something magical about that. And that's if anything got lost along the way, it was that.
Mm, it's the gaps between the planned stuff that's always the most interesting, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And I think any kind of... Let me make a comparison now between our lives, which is ludicrous. That is Rock FM, pop music station, despite the name, based in Preston, Lancashire. I would call being on drive time there was like doing your first, doing the Grange Hill episode.
Yeah.
And then moving to breakfast would be like doing the Star Wars one.
Sure.
Creatively speaking.
Absolutely.
In the sense that on drive, we probably had one set of notes given to us in 3 years. Sure. As a result, and I do think it's as a result, we had the largest audience share of any drive time show in the country.
Brilliant. I love it.
And the way that our thought process went making that show was at the start of the show, whatever took my eye that day would be the direction that we ran in, and it would probably stretch the show. So Jamie being forced to go and buy a paddling pool, and then it'd be lowered into the paddling pool by TV adventurer Paul Rose, could happen in one show. It was thought of on the spot.
Yeah.
And the key to that was that there was no... The key to that success, I suppose, was the idea that we couldn't fail. There was no...
Sure.
No one's going to tell us off. They're leaving us to it. They don't have a clue what we're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's just see how much we can get away with before we're fired.
Yeah, now, absolutely.
That as a mentality is brilliant. And then moved.
It's so freeing.
You know radio a bit, but you moved to breakfast, and all eyes are on you.
Of course.
You go to bed at 8 o'clock in the evening. You have no light. You live in constant horrific jet lag. You have nothing to talk about,
but
the logic there is, you know, you talk in 5-6 minute chunks, you plan everything every 20 minutes is different, like there's a lot of planning, there's a lot of discussion, and there's three or four different layers of bosses who are going to turn up at any point in the week and give you notes on what you've done, and you become so inside your own head. Is that an alarm? Is something going horribly
wrong?
That's
why I'm just opening my dishwasher. The cycle's finished.
Excellent.
It's stopped now. Sorry, dude.
Thank God for that.
Yeah.
Just the sound of an alarm and you running.
I love
the idea that if the house was burning down, you'd still carry on listening to me talk about breakfast.
I would.
So, and yet you become... It became... It came... it got to the point where if I had an idea in my own head, and I still think like this a little bit in radio, when me and you work in the same place now, and the boss said to me last week, let's have a meeting about what you do on the show. And it filled me with dread immediately.
It would me.
Because it screwed me up. And I go, as soon as I think of an idea now, I can hear the voices of those 12 people objecting to any idea.
Yeah,
and you go,
totally
do you know what? It doesn't matter. The thing is, the idea doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I really don't think it. If you get the right people, it's
totally understand
for me
what
that
you're saying.
The stuff I remember of your Bring Back series was you sitting in a car. I don't remember whose house you were sat outside of, but you were complaining because your piles were killing you. You'd been there for 12 hours and it was too hot. And however true or however exaggerated that was,
it was completely true.
I bet it was. That's the stuff. That's what I wanted to watch. That was what I was watching. So. Yeah. When things get more important, when the pressure's on and the suits get either more involved or you just put the pressure on yourself, it's that stuff that gets forgotten about. It's
completely.
And there's the danger. That's the danger, I think, you know.
I always struggle. You're saying just then about having that meeting and being asked those questions. I've always struggled with that, and I do to this day. And I've had this conversation twice recently where I've been talking about people asking me what I want to do or what do you plan on doing, and those questions alone make my psoriasis flare up because I've got nothing.
And the
I've
acid reflux that we've talked
and
about
the acid
before.
Reflux.
Me too. I had a little burp coming up then when you said my
honestly,
psoriasis.
Howell, if I'm asked by anybody in a position of power, what do you want to do? I'm reaching for the rennies in my pocket.
Me too.
Because I've got nothing. I can't answer that question.
I have to wing it. The stuff that interests me in life is the stuff that happens when people are slightly on, Russell, the guy I mentioned earlier to, Russell Gomer, he's in Stella. He lives in Wales, in Pontypridd. He should have been huge, but he's always lived in the valleys. He's been a theatre actor, and he's a total sociopath. Complete weirdo, and I love him, and I write with him all the time, and it's
brilliant.
Never difficult. And he's
brilliant.
A genius. And one thing that he said to me once about acting in a farce was, you have to have 50% of your brain has to be looking after the lines that you've learned. But you have to have half of your brain has to be completely blank and open, you know, and that's a good thing. There shouldn't be fear involved with that. You just go in. That's the joy of it.
Absolutely right.
And it's so hard to explain to people when, you know, people have earned money and they're putting money into you with this idea, Justin. So I want to know what I'm going to get. And you can't go, you're going to get a blank piece of paper. And it's
going to
be magic.
Yeah, you'll get a blank bit of paper or you might get a side of paper with random sentences, totally random, disconnected thoughts that won't make any sense and they barely make sense to you.
Yes.
That's what you're getting for your money.
Yeah.
Great. So you start on Sunday. Brilliant.
It's like, tell me what to do. Give me a structure and let me disrupt it. That's where it's funny to me. Like,
you're absolutely
things
right.
Things are interesting.
Yeah. There's a company, and obviously I won't say who they are, but recently they asked me to go in for a meeting. And they said, well, we've got some ideas and, we want to run a few things past you and we'll hear your ideas. And already I start scratching. And let's have this meeting. Of course, I went into the meeting and they didn't have any ideas. And of course, I've got nothing.
Yeah.
So, like an hour later, we sort of brainstormed something sort of on the spot. And then they got back to me a few weeks later and they said, we really like that idea that you came up with on the spot, but we don't think it will work. So, would you like to come back in for another brainstorm? Anyway, and I said, well, why don't you give me that outline first?
Yeah.
If you can give me that outline, and it can be an incredibly loose outline.
Yeah.
In fact, for me, the looser, the better.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, give me an outline and then just sort of wind me up and then, you know, let me go within that. And that's always been how I work the best.
Part of the reason, at drama school where I studied directing, I got into clowning quite quite a lot. I've always been into comedy and the clown in the pure clown sense. And I always, when I watched you, I always thought, this guy is a fucking clown. I always wondered how self-aware you are. Did you ever do a clowning class?
Yes, I did, because actually we made I am a fully registered clown with my own egg in the Clown Museum here in London. But this was much later on. So I'm very much a clown. I've always been a clown. Very aware of that fact.
Are you a fan of Chaplin and Laurel and Hardy?
Chaplin, no. Laurel and Hardy, yes.
Right, we need to get into this. I had this discussion with Lee Mack once. He doesn't like Chaplin either. And a lot of you comedians don't like Chaplin.
Well,
why don't you like Chaplin?
I don't dislike Chaplin.
Too much
pathos.
I'm not
a fan of it. No, because I'm a big fan of pathos. So I have no problem with that. Mm. Who doesn't admire Chaplin, or at the very least admire him as a filmmaker?
Yeah.
So that's a given. So you look at Chaplin now and it's beautiful. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
But when I was a boy, I liked Chaplin and I remember loving him eating his shoe. You know, I thought that was wonderful.
Yeah.
I don't think, could I eat my own shoe? I don't think I could do that. It's wonderful. But I loved Harold Lloyd and I loved Laurel and Hardy, and there's something more. I mean, Harold Lloyd was a stuntman, so there was something more thrilling for me about Harold Lloyd, and there was something much more obviously slapsticky about Laurel and Hardy and the relationship between the two of them. I think they were physically funnier than Chaplin. I think Chaplin was the filmmaker, so there's the distinction. That's it for me. Chaplin didn't make me laugh, but I think he was clearly the filmmaker. Laurel and Hardy and Harold Lloyd made me laugh.
I think we should call this podcast No World for Clowns. Clowns, and I'll explain why. Because I think when you're talking about the commissioning thing, for me, if I was in charge of the channel that put Justin Lee Collins on, it would be find the straightest format you could. I was going to say Strictly Come Dancing, but then you did the spin-off of that years ago.
Strictly Come Dancing on 3.
But you know, Antiques Roadshow.
Yeah,
with you putting it, that's it.
I'd do it.
The straight world, with a clear structure that you don't have to worry about because your psoriasis will go through the roof.
That's right.
And it's you disrupting it. And that's
absolutely
the stuff that I think, when it comes to comedy, there's so much mileage in that. And Will Ferrell's realised that. He'll get a straight situation, straight guy, whatever, and screw it up. But there's not.
Yeah.
That is so hard to pitch to commissioners. That's difficult to explain.
Yeah. Absolutely. And that pitch, what you said, is exactly the thing that finally, after years of up and down and trying, it's exactly what you've just said is what finally opened the doors for me.
Right.
Absolutely that.
Really?
Yeah, completely.
Well, I'm a
completely.
Genius. There we go.
You are a genius.
Thank you.
Are a genius. Mm-hmm. And that was, if you remember, the Celebrity Olympics on Channel 4. It was called The Games.
Yeah.
And there was a spin-off show on E4 that was like the Games live at Trackside. It was live in the afternoon for the heats.
Yeah.
And then it followed the main show on Channel 4 live in the evening every night for 10 days. And Channel 4 did it every year for 4 years. And I did the last two series.
Mm.
Now, I'd just come from the BBC, where, as you mentioned, I did the first companion show for the first series of Strictly Come Dancing.
Yeah.
Then I did another companion show for another BBC series called Fat Nation. So I did Fat Nation on 3. Yeah.
I didn't see then that. I saw the first one. I saw you in the
Strictly one.
I'm aware of you, the Strictly one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And basically what happened is the people at the BBC, well, actually one person at the BBC went, get him off of my screen. Couldn't bear me.
Yeah.
And it was literally one person, came down to one person who clearly was a big decision maker.
Mm.
Couldn't bear me. And it wasn't a personal thing at all. Just saw me on the screen, get him off.
Oh, God.
Whose idea was this?
Yeah.
So And what I used to hear, Hal, and this is this is completely true, mm-hmm. early days, I heard this more times than I care to remember. But I would go to a new home, or I would start a new job in television, obviously, I'm talking about. Mm. And somebody at some point would say to me, "Oh, I hated you. I hated you. But now I work with you, I can see what you're doing."
No, not just that. We would get called up when we started a new show, a new radio show. We would get called up and they would say, "You are shit." Yeah. They would say it to us. We go, "Hello." Yeah. And they go, "Listen, I just want to say, I've been listening to Rock FM for 20 years and I think you're shit," and we'd turn it off. And we'd go, "Well, thank you.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, thanks for that."
And then they'd ring back 2 weeks later and they'd go, I really didn't get you at first. We heard that more than anything. I did not understand it at first, but now I get it.
Well, yeah, and I think it goes back to, well, obviously, it's that doing something different, obviously, but also that sort of clowning thing, and it's about self-awareness.
It's clowning, it's going...
It's the appearance of stupid. Does the appearance of stupid actually mean that this person is stupid? Right? Does he know what he's doing? And that's... And I sort of still joke about that now, like I joke about not knowing what I'm doing, but of course I know... It doesn't mean it's going to work, but, you know, I'm still trying, and I'm still taking chances, but I know what I'm doing.
But that's so difficult to get across to bosses if they don't get you. If they
completely.
Don't get it, you can't, because you know what they won't do? They won't say to you, "Do you know what you're doing?" They will just give you notes and advice that as you're hearing this advice, you know, we've been told things before, you know, just really simple stuff like, "Now, one thing that you should do is say the station name at the beginning of the link." And we would walk out, and the number of times we would walk out of a meeting and go, "How fucking stupid do they think we are?" How do you begin to deal with that situation? Of course I know what I'm doing.
It's all of that. There's a thing, I still do it now. In fact, I was doing it at work, you know, where we worked together. I was doing it the other day. I was applauding the time, and I've been doing that for years. It's that old radio thing of, like, you know, say the time, do the time. And I think the other day it was 7 minutes past three and I started applauding the time. And I remember years ago on XFM, do you remember lovely Kevin Greening?
Yeah.
Who sadly no longer with us. Yeah. Former Radio 1 breakfast show presenter from Bristol. Lovely, lovely man. Sadly no longer with us, Kevin Greening.
Yeah.
And he used to follow me at XFM for a period. And when I first started there, he came in one day and he said to me, "I've been listening to you." And he said, "At first I was thinking, why is he clapping the time?" And he said, "But..." And he said, "But now," he said, "I get it." He said, "I know what you're doing. I know what you're doing."
But I mean, people don't. It's not us that's the stupid ones, is it? That's the problem. You have to go. Surely you. How long did you spend wondering if? What did you think of me? Did you think I was actually insane because I'm clapping the time?
Like, I really love time.
What? My God.
But you can, you know, you can explain it, and it's just, and it's, I mean, I've always, this is, my thing is, I've always said there's nothing to explain. There's nothing to explain. So people, if ever anyone has said to me, like, "I don't get it," or I always say there's nothing to get. Forget about getting it.
Yes.
Like, there's no point that you are missing.
No.
This is just it.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that I'm not making choices. I'm making choices. They might be in the moment, but I'm choosing to applaud 7 minutes past three.
Yeah, yeah. And when you meet someone, when you have someone, and this is the situation we very much got to a few years ago, really, and it didn't change, is that when you get to a point where you sit and listen to that back with a boss, and the boss doesn't crack a smile and looks at you and says, "Why are you... Tell me what your answer would be. Why are you applauding the time?"
Literally what my answer would be?
Yeah.
I just thought it was a lovely time. That would be my answer.
And
that would be my exact answer. If I was called in for a meeting...
And smile and he just shakes his head at you. Yeah, don't do that.
Then I would probably say, "You might have a point. I should have clapped 309. That's what I would say. But I wouldn't be able to ever give him the answer that he was looking for, and that's the point. I'd never be able to give him the answer, which is why, not that I was ever asked, this, but going back to Strictly, this particular person at the BBC wasn't even asking me the question. She was just, get him off. Get him off. And then I found like-minded individuals at Channel 4. And God love them. And I'm eternally grateful. Just went, yeah, we'll have him. He can stay here for a bit.
Yeah, that's it.
And that's the difference.
Yeah.
Because you're never going to find the answers.
No.
Because, no. Again, my opinion is there aren't any. There aren't any. I'm only posing questions, Howell.
Exactly. That's what you do. And the process is... The process is built to weed out silliness. Once you get a committee of people, especially at the BBC, there's so much, you know, and there's reasons for this, but there's so many levels and there's so much committee that goes into something. How are you ever going to end up with something that's silly? Because it's not given a value. There's just no...
Look, how
could they get rid of Shooting Stars, for example?
I know.
You know?
I know.
Keeping how much shit compared to that? And so anything that has a value that appears to be silly is just so difficult to defend. You need someone who can take that risk and who's on the
And that's why I'm a big fan of, particularly at the moment where there's still a lot of creatives out there, a lot of creative people out there who, you know, we're looking for gaps in the market and they see different things, and there's people still willing to take that risk and say, okay, we've got this idea and we've got the backing, and maybe we've got, you know, the money or a certain amount of money to put into this idea, but we don't quite know exactly how it's going to work, but we want it to work and we want to do this.
Brilliant.
So that's where hopefully I come in and they'll go, right, you sit there and, you know, there's the mic or there's the camera, and you just, you know, do what you do. Don't swear, but just do what you do.
Yeah. I mean, if your life hadn't been slightly fucked up over the last couple of years, you should have presented Top Gear. It should have been you in that.
Well, do you know what? I couldn't have done it.
Because you can't
drive. I went on it because I can't drive. I've got too many points on my license to host Top Gear. But me and Alan Carr went on it as guests.
Yeah, you did.
And I didn't particularly enjoy that day. I think probably Alan enjoyed it more than I did.
Really?
But this is the honest truth. Mm. And you may not believe it, but I'm not qualified to host a show like that. And even if you go back, let's say if you go back to 2006, 2007, I can't imagine that particular job ever of being offered to me. But if it had have been, I would have said no.
Really?
Yeah, I would have said no.
Why?
Because I can't do it. Because past a certain point in my life, and this is completely true, and this is coming from a man who was a twiglet. I was a 10-foot twiglet on television and cinema screens, advertising twiglets.
Oh,
I advertised yogurts.
Oh, right.
I did, yeah. I did.
Metaphorically.
I was literally a twiglet. I looked like a 10-foot shit, and I'm running into the sea on Brighton Beach, screaming. I'm covered in curry, I'm burning up, because I'm advertising new curry-flavoured twiglets. So that was back in about year 2000, I think that was.
Yeah.
So there was a time where I took the money jobs. I just took, you know, the money because, you know, we wanted to get married and we wanted to buy our first house and all of that stuff. Yeah. We wanted to live. So there was a time where I took the jobs purely because it was earning a living.
Mm-hmm.
But then it got to a certain point where I never, ever took a job because of the money, and I never took a job from about, I can safely say, from about 2004 onwards, I never took a job that creatively I didn't think, I can do this, I can do this, I love it, or there's something I can bring to it, even when... I'll never forget, I was standing in my mum and dad's bedroom at home. I got the phone call from my then agent to say they're bringing back Come Dancing, and it's going to be a celebrity, pro-celebrity version. They're going to call it Strictly Come Dancing. It's going to be live, and they want you to host the companion show. They'd like you to go to London and have a meeting. And I burst out laughing, and I stood there, and I laughed my ass off. But here's the thing. When I was a little boy, my mum would tell you one of my favourite television programmes was Come Dancing. I've never danced. I don't know why I loved it, but I loved it with all of my heart. And I thought I could do that. I'd love to do that. I'd love to do it. And probably from that point on, it's always been first and foremost a creative decision.
That's the right thing to do. It's the right thing to, that's where I've got to as well, which is why I'm sat at home on the couch most of the week.
Oh, dude. Hey, there's nothing wrong with Homes Under the Hammer.
Well, no, no, it's not on. It's not on. I'm a massive fan
of A Place in the Sun.
Now, you see, there's another example. I want to see you host A Place in the Sun.
I'd love to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I'd jump at that with my heart. It's my favourite programme.
I think there's a place for a new travel programme. You know, the old Judith Chalmers thing, the proper holiday programme.
Well, see, I watch A Place in the Sun. I love it. I really love it. It's one of my favourite programmes. I think Jasmine Harmon, who's one of the presenters on it, is fantastic. If I was going to Tenerife and I wanted to buy a flat, I want Jasmine there. I want Jasmine with me.
Exactly. Right?
Now, I love it, but there are some presenters on A Place in the Sun, and they always intro it with, "Well, I've been developing property for 12 years. And I think, well, have you? Really?
Yes.
But it's sort of, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, does it?
No. Well, this is what I mean about Top Gear. Is I almost think that the more structure that's around you, the more creative opportunity you've got to screw it up. And if you're not bothered about the money, I'm not saying take the job for the money. I'm saying take the job because instead of that new series of Top Gear came back and they were doing the same old Top Gear with different presenters, it was like, no, that first episode of the new series of Top Gear should have been 1 hour real time of you in a car with a dashboard cam. Trying to drive the wrong way on the road in from France to Luxembourg.
Well,
or, you know,
see, well, that's the thing. I mean, people, you know, there was an awful lot of stories about, well, now the new ex-host, Chris Evans, throwing up. Apparently, kept throwing up in the car.
Wow.
And now that was used as like a stick to beat him. Oh, he's not a speed freak. He keeps throwing up. Now, if I was ever asked to host Top Gear, I would only say yes if they let me throw up.
Yeah, and if they showed that.
If they showed it. If they let me say, look, I drive a Honda Civic, I know nothing about cars, and if you put me in that Maserati, I'm going to blow chunks. It's going to happen.
How could that have been criticised?
I know. It's just, I don't understand.
This is what I mean. Like, it's the most stupid decision ever. And the weight of the pressure of the money, again, made them go for something that would fail. Like, don't do that. Do the exact opposite.
Exactly
fuck
right.
Fuck it up more than anybody could fuck it up. And then you instantly level the expectations.
Yeah,
and you can
absolutely
build it up again.
Yeah, why do you have to pretend to be something that you're not?
It's just mad. And that can only come through, you know, the level of pressure that's on it and all of that. Yeah. Anyway, listen, we've gone on so long. We've gone on half an hour longer than you put aside.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it has been a pleasure.
Anytime, brother.
Let's get you back on the box set pod.
Yeah, I'd love to do that, mate. That would be fantastic. Because I could talk to you all day. You're such a lovely man.
I know, we should do more of this. It's good. Well,
yeah, let's do more of this.
Yeah, but you give the impression that we will do more of this. I'm aware that you would promise this to anybody. But
no, but I mean, I wouldn't promise it if I didn't mean it. Let's do more because it's just been an absolute joy.
Yeah.
I could talk, you know, Stranger Things like we did on the other podcast or throwing up in Maseratis on this podcast. I could talk about that stuff all day long.
Do you know what I've just realised? Maybe this podcast should take a turn, right? Instead of it being me interviewing, you know, I'll interview a few creative people, but then it should just be every episode is me and you coming up with a new programme idea.
Yeah.
And we keep doing it until someone gives us £20 million to do it. You know, until we come up with the perfect
The perfect sort of format that we can sell around the world and then retire. Yeah,
that hopefully no one will nick.
But, Howell, I would just like to say, though, that I love that you're doing this.
Thanks.
And this is the wonderful thing about podcasts at the moment. Mm. More of this, because this is where, in my opinion, most of the creative stuff is happening. It's people that are just people that have got the gumption and the inclination and the desire and the will just to do it themselves.
Yeah.
And that's what you're doing, because in this case, you're the man, you're the creative, and you're the suit.
This is true.
God,
I think
love you,
you
for
also
it.
Have to be not under contract with anybody to have these conversations.
That helps, doesn't it? Yeah, that helps. Yeah, that does. That does help. That does help.
It could be called the Honest Dustbin.
Oh, I love that. Let's do the Honest Dustbin. I love it.
Right. Brilliant. Thanks, Justin.
Thank you, my brother. Anytime.
Wait there. I'm going to tell you a secret idea. Hang on.
Sweet.
So thank you very much to Justin Lee Collins. Again, find groups of people who trust you and work with them seems to be the key, which is what Mike Myers said last week. It gets more and more interesting that it's about the team of people that you manage to find. But also that Justin felt like when the pressure got big, the quality went down, which I think is also true. Even he, with his larger-than-life personality, struggled to keep the moments of magic. So if you want moments of magic, you must keep the talent in the right balance between not feeling the pressure and wanting to get the job done. That's interesting to me as well.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Who will be on the next spin-off? We'll find out next time there's a spin-off. Thank you for listening.